Okay, so it's the top of the hour according to my computer, and I guess we'll get started. And this is our fourth and final virtual phase of our symposium this year. And I know that many of you have been with us over the course of the last three sessions. We have been evaluating the sessions with your input, and largely, I think people have found these sessions to be quite valuable. So I wanted to let you all know that we will be recording the session, and these recordings, in addition to the slides, will be posted and made available for future access. So they will be available on the CNI website. And we're also looking at potentially having the materials available through CNA. So we're not sure yet about InfoWay, but we're going to see if we can put them on to our forum there. So welcome, everybody. It looks like we have a great attendance again today. And we're very pleased and fortunate to have with us a couple of special guest speakers. I wanted to first of all just acknowledge our sponsorship for the sessions that we have been holding over the last couple of months. I'd like to acknowledge Canada Health InfoWay for their support, as well as Cerner Corporation. And both of these organizations have been consistently supporting our work over the last 5 years, and we very much appreciate it. So thank you. We look forward to your continued participation. Anyway, I'm going to not take up more time. I want to turn this over to our speakers today. And first up on the agenda today is Dr. Michelle Acorn. And many of you will know Michelle. Michelle has been at previous sessions that we've had. And Michelle is the Chief Nursing Officer in Ontario within the Ontario Ministry of Health. So she's going to talk to us about the work that the group of chief nurses across the country have been engaged in over the last year, and the documentation of a future vision, which some of you may have already had an opportunity to read, is something that I encourage you to have a look at. So Michelle, I'm going to turn it over to you. You can tell the group anything else you want about yourself. Michelle was one of the recently inducted fellows in the Canadian Academy of Nursing, so congratulations, and welcome to you, and look forward to your session today.
And can I remind you to just use the chat if you have questions or comments for Michelle and or Jennifer?
Thank you, Peggy. I was just going to say that.
Okay.
All right, so we'll use the chat. We may get an interruption well into our session from the emergency response system being tested, but we'll just ignore that and carry on. Okay. At the end of the session as well, I just want to let you know that we will have time for questions, and we will have some questions that we want to pose to you about future sessions. So thank you. Michelle, over to you.
Great. Thanks. Happy to be here virtually with you. I'm from Lindsay, Ontario right now from my office. Hopefully my dog does not bark. Thank you again to Peggy and to Lynn as well, and Jody for the kind invitation. I really think the theme of informing healthcare improvement really flows with my conversation today. I do bring greetings from the Principal Nursing Advisors Task Force, which are all the advisors across all the provinces and territories in Canada, and I'm representing them as their co-chair today. And I thought we would actually present to you the Federal, Provincial, and Territorial Committee on Health Workforce work plan and bring you up to speed as well. Can I go back? I can't. My apologies. Today, I'd like to, in the 20 minutes, review the development of the vision, what the vision is, and what we're going to highlight for advancing the four visions for our work plan priority that has actually been approved by the Committee for Health Workforce that actually reports to the Conference of Deputy Ministers. And we do have four priority areas that I will highlight as we move forward. So what have we been up to? Well, as you know, we've all been living through a COVID and the COVID context, which actually will have implications on our work plan and some of our timelines that we will need to be flexible and responsive with. But in the spring of 2019, I do know some of you were in attendance. We did have a one-day roundtable on the draft of what the vision of nursing would look like specifically. And then in June, we met in Ottawa and we had a one-day pan-Canadian roundtable on what the draft and vision is. And we really thank you all for your collaboration and engagement and expertise that really helped to form this work plan. And we look forward to your continued engagement and collaboration as well. In October, we did share what we heard report and we distributed to those who did participate in our Pan-Canadian Roundtable. We did have our vision approved, as I talked about, and then our PNAF members have met to develop a proposed action to advance the vision, and we're well underway, as you will see right now. So this is pretty exciting times. And when we look at the three interdependent pillar work that's happening, it's really synergy between these three core elements that we're going to hone in on from a pillar stance. We're looking at the Pan-Canadian Nursing Regulatory Framework. We're looking at an integrated entry-level nursing education. And we're going to look at optimum scope of practice. And you can see the intersection and the interdependence in these areas. If we just look at the Pan-Canadian Nursing Regulatory Framework, obviously we're going to talk about a National Nursing Unique Identifier, but we need to modernize our approach to regulation. We need to look at common requirements, what those entry-level competencies look like, things such as a single code of ethics and harmonized scopes of practice. When we look at how we synergize with entry-level nursing education, we need to look at opportunities that are going to evolve to meet our population health needs, specifically in rural and urban areas. We really need to think about how we're going to strengthen and enhance that partnerships between employers and academic institutions and our educators as well, and our approaches going forward interprofessionally. And in light of COVID, look at the digital technology and how we're moving to telehealth, for example, as well, and what the learning platforms may look like. Lastly, when we look at this week in scope of practice statement, how we look at consistency across all the provinces and territories, how we harmonize them, and optimize them, not just with existing, but actually the needs of our population health moving forward. And how do we more importantly look into knowledge translation and what that looks like as well for communication strategies. Just making sure you can hear me okay. Great, thanks, Jennifer. So when we look at our work plan priorities, the first priority that we're gonna talk about for maximum impact is actually the single national nursing unique identifier for all nurses in Canada. And I want to remind you, there's four categories of nurses in Canada, okay? There are registered psychiatric nurses, more in the Western provinces. We have registered nurses, we have nurse practitioners, as well as we have licensed practical nurses. And in Ontario, we know them as registered practical nurses. Right there alone shows you discrepancies between the categories and what that looks like for role clarity for a mobile, nimble workforce as well, and how we think about harmonizing it. When we look at a single national unique identifier, what our desired outcome is really to create the conditions of how to implement this number for all nurses in Canada and what that looks like. And we really want to make sure it's anchored in strong rationale that is always leveraged with patient safety and the warning systems that can identify nurses that could potentially impact Canadians. And in Ontario, for example, as you know, with the long-term care public inquiry, it was revealed that there's potential opportunities to really strengthen from that regulation stance as well. We really need to think about facilitating labor movement, how we actually improve the accuracy of our workforce data. We know, how do we facilitate health workforce planning in terms of education and the health human resources that we're going to require? And more importantly, how do we actually share this quality information for efficiency and effectiveness? And more importantly, are we going to be proactive or reactive? Are we going to go into forecasting and that is best informed to drive our nursing resources, which is more than 50% of our health workforce planning as well? And then how this is Sentinel work. It's in priority one right now because this is the first step in our harmonized, consistent approach to regulation that we will be undertaking. Priority two looks at that pan-Canadian harmonized nursing regulatory framework specifically with the outcome of we want that current nursing regulatory landscape to have a common understanding across Canada that, again, it promotes that patient safety and it aligns across all the provinces and territories as well. And why this is important is it obviously is patient safety throughout, role clarity, interprofessional and team-based care, that labor mobility option, of course, and it really does help with cost efficiencies and effectiveness as well. The third priority we're going to highlight today is the Common Entry Level Nursing Competency Framework. So we need a current entry level competency for all the four categories and a common understanding of what that looks like. Again, this links to patient safety. If they don't understand our role clarity, that is a challenge. How do we actually formulate and innovate unique care models, for example, to optimize our scope of practice, not just competence, but confidence as well? How do we facilitate the education across a career trajectory or career progression as well, from novice to expert, if you think about Benner's or Dreyfus's model, for example. And then more importantly, how are we going to assist our teams and our employers to understand the commonalities as well as the nuances or differences between the nursing categories, and more importantly about nursing collectiveness as well? And how do we actually help consistency with that registration process for internationally educated nurses right now? We're in a really important time period right now with COVID-19 presenting an opportunity as well as a challenge, but internationally educated nurses is even the approach across Canada can have delayed entrance into Canada to utilize for our health workforce as well. Priority four is optimizing what the existing scope of practice and alignment looks like in Canada right now, as well as where it needs to be in the future in terms of, you know, that vision and strategy and predictive modeling actually will look like. We also want to think about how do we optimize and align what that scope of practice is in Canada. It is quite variable and diverse, as you can tell, across all the provinces and territories. And we need this, again, linking to safety and role clarity, because we know cost-effective care is delivered through high-quality care at the optimum maximum scope of practice, ensuring that we have that knowledge, skill, and judgment so nurses can practice to their full potential and improve access to care and health outcomes for patients, residents, families, populations, and communities. So this is actually what the plan is going to look like. If we hone in on the unique identifier right now, we are going to look at the conditions that we need. We want to actually, the true activity is looking at the provincial and territorial readiness and what these prerequisites look like for their willingness and ability to onboard to this. What our deliverable will be is a comprehensive report identifying this status, and we're targeting in the winter of 2021 to 22 at this point. And we have just listed a few stakeholders here. I didn't put in everybody, but it's going to be evolving as well. And I certainly can see CNIA probably playing a role in this. And obviously I would expect a reach out on this in writing if you would like to be involved as well and what that looks like. Because, for example, the Canadian Council of Registered Nurse Regulators, and of course, we're going to look at British Columbia and Ontario are the two co-leads from a provincial territorial stance on this. So I'll be intimately involved in this, as will my BC colleagues, but we'll look at a pan-Canadian stance. Priority two, when we look at that harmonized regulatory framework, we talked about what the common understanding outcome is driven towards patient safety. However, we're going to map out two areas. The activities are going to be looking at the regulatory requirements in the jurisdictions, and we're going to really hone in on summarizing areas of divergence and commonalities. And then we're going to also do a jurisdictional scan of nursing codes of ethics and working with partners to develop a common code across Canada. And you will see we're targeting them in the summer of 2021 and the fall of 2020. And of course, the Canadian nurse regulators and the PT regulators and collaboratives will be involved in this as well. And this is just a high level, quick slide for discussion, of course. Priority three for the entry level nursing competencies. We are going to look at a collating a competency document and performing a critical nursing analysis where we're all going to review what the commonalities and differences are as well. Then we're going to try to collate, compare, contrast, and actually highlight the entry level competencies in all the categories in the spring of 2020. Last priority four for optimizing scope of practice, pan-Canadian wide, you'll see our deliverables that we're going to really focus on are, I think of you, Peggy White, when we talk about this, because we've talked about informatics and infographics and things like that before, but we're really realize we have to go back to some of the basics about nursing terminology reference document and what a nursing infographic will look like to employers. And then we're going to really focus on discrepancies between scopes of practice across jurisdictions and develop, strategies for what that looks like. We'll be identifying a report to highlight these discrepancies between the scopes of practice. And then a work plan will be developed with our national regulatory bodies in consultation with many of you here today and our Canadian nurse leaders to identify these discrepancies. We'll also be working with CASN and other Canadian stakeholders, as you will see as well. I think watching for time, I left a couple of minutes, but I'm wondering, Jennifer, if we want to go over to you and then round out with questions at the end, if that would be good. I can stop my screening.
Yeah, that's a good idea, Michelle. We'll take questions at the end. So we'll turn it over to Jennifer. Dr. Rayner comes to us from the Association of Ontario Health Centers, the Alliance for Healthcare Communities, has a background in epidemiology and statistics and is leading some very important research for her organization. And I'll let you tell them a little bit more about that, Jennifer. Thank you.
Great. Thanks, Lynn. Yeah, so I'm the Director of Research and Evaluation at the Alliance for Healthcare Communities, and we support community health centers, nurse practitioner-led clinics, Aboriginal health access centers, and community-governed family health teams in Ontario. And I'm going to be sort of walking you through a bit of a journey we've had in the collection of comprehensive team-based data, but really with the goal more and more so often of improving healthcare and client outcomes. And I think at the beginning, we were so keen to sort of tell our story or just, and now we're really transitioning on how we can use that data for improvement and action. So I'm going to be walking you through a bit of that journey. So within the CHCs in Ontario, this might be familiar to some of you, but about 20 years ago, we're all paid salary. So physicians, nurse practitioners, there's no shadow billing. You know, in some cases we're almost invisible in administrative databases, but also the clients we serve often are non-insured. So we really needed to have an evaluation framework or a set of data that would describe what we did and how we did it and who we cared for. So we developed this evaluation framework, and it's really morphed into this model of health and well-being, which is our sort of our North Star. It's really how it's our roadmap to service delivery. And you can see around the edges, there's the values, and we've got these all these different attributes of the care we provide. And I think what's important is every one of our 110 organizations in Ontario have signed on to this model of health and well-being. And you can see that it's team-based, it's accountable and efficient, it's based on determinants of health, you know, it's anti-oppressive and culturally safe. And really this is just, again, drives how we provide care. So I've just put a little reference there if people are interested in learning more about the model. I won't spend too much time on it, but again, every organization follows this model. There's a common adage in the CHC world that says, if you've seen one CHC, you've seen one CHC, because they're completely built by the communities they serve, and they're, all of their activities are grounded in the communities they've served, but they all follow the same model. So even though they might look different, they all have these goals and attributes in common. So a key part of this model of health and well-being and the evaluation framework that we developed to really describe the services includes a bunch of common stuff. So we, all of our members, the 110 organizations, collect consistent data across all of the different provider types. So if you're a nurse practitioner, a dietitian, a social worker, a physician, a peer worker, everybody collects the same data. And we were very deliberate in that decision. So we wanted to make sure that everyone's work counted, and that even though we provide comprehensive team-based care that's very integrated and people work together all the time, it was important that everyone's work could be teased out so we could see who was doing what. So we collect really rich data about the clients we serve. This includes all sorts of equity based data and race based data, so we can really understand and how to and action how to remove health disparities. Every single provider records what we call encounters, which is really just visit data. And this reflects coded standardized data, really describing the type of encounters they've had, all of the issues or diagnoses they've dealt with, and the types of services and procedures they've done. And then we have group activities. So all of those sorts of social support activities, we've just recently completed a social prescribing initiative. So that was all captured in our EMR. And what's great is this allows us to really understand the processes and outcomes that all of our clients and our providers achieve by working in this model. So this has been implemented, like I said, across all of the different 110 organizations in Ontario. And I'm also working with CHCs across Canada to pilot these data elements, because they really fit into content standards that CHI-HI have developed, or, you know, just good data standards that we're finding more and more are being used in EMRs. And we've added, got this extra added component of equity data. So something that was pretty foundational for us in order to do this is we, prior to probably about 10 years ago, we used to push a button on our servers, and our data would sort of flow to the Ministry of Health in Ontario. We didn't see our data. You know, people were putting it into their EMRs, but they didn't use the data. They didn't understand the data. They were just constantly kind of entering this data into their EMR. And it was more widgets. It was really, it wasn't meaningful to them. And about 10 years ago, our whole sector, all 110 organizations, decided to kind of take control of their own data again. And this was a really foundational shift for us, because we decided to own, use, and share our data amongst all of ourselves. So when you talk about informing healthcare improvement, this was huge, because now we could benchmark ourselves against peers. We could look at really designing a data warehouse that was meaningful for us for clinical decisions, program planning, quality improvement, all of our accountability and ongoing data quality. So it wasn't until we took this step that we were able to do all of this extra work to really, what I keep calling, close the loop and make sure it improves care. So we, you know, I'm going kind of fast forward through our 20-year journey, but we had all of this rich data. We had a data warehouse. We didn't do much with that data. Again, we were, you know, we were sort of invisible in all these administrative databases. So I've been with the community health centers for years, but about 4 years ago, I was asked to start this research alliance or alliance research program. And this, again, was one of those foundational moments, because I was a research team of one, and, you know, you can't do much by yourself. And I think that's a common statement for most things. So I collaborated with universities across Ontario and Canada, and also started working with places like CHI-HI and the Institute for Clinical and Evaluative Sciences, ICES, because, again, our data wasn't going anywhere. It was invisible. And again, we serve some of the clients some of our clients are the most experience the most barriers to care. They're the people without insurance, or the people who are experiencing homelessness, or really significant mental health and addictions. And none of that data was flowing into these administrative databases. So with our standardized data, I was able to mimic all the other data that's going into administrative data and have that data populate databases. So now all of our data is available for population-based studies and research studies. And so this was a great step, I think, in our journey, because again, when you're trying to look at change, you want to have evidence and research to guide that work. And the reason I'm talking about this, because I'm going to talk about two case studies that we've done with CHI-HI that really demonstrate the benefit of having standardized coded data that's able to be linked with all the other administrative data sets. So we started out on this process with CHI-HI. They didn't even think our data could be linked. You know, how could EMR data be extracted from all of the team-based providers within a CHC, and how could it possibly be linked to all of the other data holdings in the province? So first of all, we had to test this out. So we created a partnership with CHI-HI just to test out the possibility of using this EMR data to link up to really understand the client journey. So that required a bunch of data sharing agreements and a whole bunch of logistical kind of stuff. But in 2018, we shared 3 years worth of data from our data warehouse with CHI-HI. And at that point, CHI-HI had never assessed EMR data with the primary care lens. So they looked at our primary care data and assessed it for quality, usability, and linkage potential. What they found was that it was very high quality. It had, everything was standardized and coded. It was consistent and it had really high reliability. And it was able to be mapped when a person had a health card number. So it's important again to remember that about 10% of our clients don't have health card numbers. And of course, then we could only use the EMR data within the CHC itself. So at that point, we wanted to look at two different topic areas that were really of importance to the CHCs themselves. So we looked at a COPD proof of concept, and then we looked at a mental health and addictions proof of concept. And our whole goal was, again, to look at that client journey through the healthcare system and link it back to primary care to test this data. So our premise with our data collection is enter once and use often. So all of our providers, like I've explained already, use an EMR, and they enter a set of standardized data plus their usual chart notes into one EMR across the province that is fairly standard across all the organizations. There's a few people that use a different EMR, but most of them use the same. But regardless of the EMR, everybody has the same standards. Every night, that data flows into what we call the BERT, which is our data warehouse. It's a business intelligence reporting tool. And it's just a big data warehouse that holds all of these data elements. We create dashboards, and we share data amongst each other, so we can do CHC benchmarkings. We've got peer groups. You can see the internal care journey. If you're a provider, you can drill down to that patient level to really see potentially who's missing an aspect of care. So you can really just drill down to unique identifiers, and we use it for all of our accountability and performance. Now, before our relationships began with CHI-HI and ICS, that's where our data stopped. So we could never look beyond our own office walls. We couldn't look at what happened to a person when they went into the hospital or visited the emergency department or saw a specialist. So with the ability to link to a place like CHI-HI or ICS with standardized data, we can now start looking at the care continuum. We can benchmark our data with people other than ourselves. So if we want to look at primary care organizations across Canada, we can do that. And we can really identify gaps in care. So are certain population groups accessing specialists the same way as other population groups are? know, who, what internal team members are being seen for people with mental health and addictions? Are there certain characteristics of people who aren't getting seen 7 days after discharge? So we can really start drilling down to figure out some improvement initiatives with using this linked data. So I'm going to quickly talk about a few of the case studies we did with COPD. And you can see here, we were able to look at a pretty nice set of demographic data. You can see that within the Alliance, all of our members, there was a small percentage, 15%, who didn't speak English at all. And 26% of the folks that had COPD lived alone. This was something that really was important for us to figure out because of this social prescribing project. We are really trying to look at the impact of isolation and loneliness on a person's health. So this helps us figure out who might need a social prescription for other sorts of activities. We know the average age is about 64 years old, and about half of the folks with COPD are male. 37.7% have a high school education, and 22.5% of the folks with COPD have an annual household income less than $15,000. So we know that a lot of people are living in poverty. When we start looking at the patient journey across the healthcare system, we saw that 3/4 of our clients with COPD had at least one emergency department visit, and an average of 5 emergency department visits overall, that averaged 5.7 hours. So it's a pretty considerable amount of emergency department time is being spent for our folks with COPD. Most ED visits resulted in the client being discharged home, but 16.2 led to a hospital admission. And we know from our data linking it to CHI-HI that 1/3 of these folks had at least one hospitalization, and 4 out of 5 patients were discharged home. So we want to then know, okay, what's the journey back to primary care? Because we know from the evidence that if they've had a visit to primary care after discharge, it reduces the risk of being admitted to the hospital again. So we know that half of our COPD clients discharged had a primary care visit within 7 days. So our lens now is, how do we actually improve that? How do we actually get more folks who are discharged followed up with primary care? So again, we can try to prevent this circle from happening. We then, what we did with that data is we provided everybody with an interactive worksheet. So we didn't want to just create a research project. We really wanted to provide data back to the CHC. And then that's my whole goal with most things I've been doing these days, really trying to provide actionable data for folks. So this worksheet went back so you could compare peer groups again. You could look at different CHCs in your region to really understand if there was somebody doing really well with their 7-day primary care visit after discharge. What were they doing? You can talk to folks to learn. Our next proof of concept was looking at mental health and addiction. And you can see here that, again, similar characteristics, 15% are non-English speaking, pretty high prevalence of mental health and addiction. 20% live alone, average age is 48, 58% female, 24% with an annual household income of $15,000, and 35% have a high school education, or 35% only have a high school education. So again, you can see within the CHC, these folks are really using a lot of resources at the CHC, which is not surprising. So 84% of the mental health and addiction clients made 5 or more visits in the follow-up year. 28% made 20 or more visits. So they're pretty high users, and they're mostly seeing physicians or nurse practitioners. Most commonly addressed issues is really just maintenance of their mental health issues. So prescription repeats and screening. 7% were referred to psychiatrists. So this we felt was pretty low. And you can see there's a lot of internal referrals going on to social workers, dietitians, and physicians. When we look at the continuum across the healthcare journey, you can see that 42% of our mental health and addiction clients had at least one emergency department visit. And there was an average of 3 ED visits over the course of the study period. And the average length of stay is 4 hours. Again, you can see that some of these emergency department visits led to a hospital admission, and 37% of the mental health and addiction clients had a primary care visit after discharge. So again, with that improvement lens, what can we do to actually make sure that more folks who are admitted to the hospital get back into the primary care so we can prevent them from being admitted again? Same sort of thing happened. We gave folks a worksheet with all of this data, able to drill down and really identify what's going on in their own organization. And they can try to make these improvements, to really help improve care. Something we're doing now, and this is where I'm going to end this conversation, is we're really trying to transition all of our Alliance members to become a learning health system. So what I've said, over the last year when I've been taking people through this journey, is we've spent a lot of time assembling relevant data and even analyzing data. We've done a pretty good job analyzing data. We often interpret results. I think we rarely have been giving tailored feedback, and even less so do we take action to improve. Now, within individual organizations, probably all of this is going on, but I think, my lens from now on is, how do I make sure that every piece of data that I send out, or how do I make sure every piece of research that I do has this action focus? So I want to be able to give tailored feedback like we did with those CHI reports, so then every person can then take action to improve. Something else we're doing is establishing a practice-based learning network. So I'm working with the 6 other academic practice-based learning networks in Ontario, and we're encouraging nurses, physicians, social workers to join our practice-based learning network so we can create communities of practice, so we can get folks involved in research. I know all of our providers have curious minds, so I'm trying to tap into that curiosity to really ensure that people can get data and have answers to questions that they need to improve care. And we're again trying to tailor all of our reports and all of our research for action and improvement, because I feel like only then can we actually close the loop and really start to improve care. So that's where I've ended. I wanted to give lots of time for questions, and my email is below. Please reach out, and I'm always willing to share anything we've done. We've got lots of materials that I can share, and know that what we're doing here, I'm working with CATCH, which is our Canadian equivalent, and we're trying to spread this across Canada for all of the community health centers in Ontario and Canada.
Fantastic. Thank you so much, Jennifer. And thank you to both of you for taking the time out of your busy schedules to be with us today. I think both presentations really are a nice way to finish up our series. And so it's now an opportunity for you to engage with both of our speakers. And if you have questions, you can put them in the chat box, or you can actually ask your question if you like, but we'd like to try and capture them as much as possible. While I'm waiting to see if anybody has a question, I'll just say there is a comment from Peggy. And I would concur, Peggy, that it is very powerful to have consistent data to tell a story and actually be able to share data across the continuum of care. And I think one of the things I was so struck by, Jennifer, your tagline, enter once and use often, is very consistent with the philosophy that we've been advocating in terms of standardized data and our dream to have nursing, adopt more and more standardized data. Question here is, did you use ICNP for nursing clinical data standards, the International Classification of Nursing Practice? Is that something that your nurses are using?
No, they're not. And I would be interested to sort of map what we're doing and see what we're missing, because there could be some gaps that we could definitely learn from.
Okay, that would be great.
Yeah, so I think I'll follow up with you just to make sure, because that would be really good to understand that better. I'll give you an example. I'm working with them on a primary care reform study right now across Canada, but we're focused on Ontario because we've been kind of like a hotbed of primary care reform. And I'm so desperately trying to bring in the nurse practitioner led clinic data, because that's a huge reform that's gone underway in Ontario. Only about 75% of them code diagnostic data. And it's so important for me to have that data to understand the complexity of folks they serve. And so, I so want these standards to be adopted across Canada, to have coded diagnostic data or coded reasons for visits, because it's just so powerful to understand and contextualize what people are doing.
Exactly. Yeah. Excellent. Michelle, a question for you as to how the 2020 vision is being shared with nurses across the country.
Yes, thanks for the question. As well as I saw a question online, I quickly chatted in and added the piece. It has been shared with the participants in the key associations who consulted as well at this point in time, which pretty well covered the bulk of consultants from provincial as well as the territories and nationally as well. You're always going to have some gaps. There seems to be a lot of interest in this work, Lynn, and more importantly, where we're at right now. And what thrills us is people are really interested in getting involved. And, a few participated too in the national consultations, and we thank you for that, because if you have something now that we actually have an approved work plan going forward that you think you can contribute to that, we're certainly open, and we want to ensure that we're utilizing the best expertise, and we don't necessarily have to do the work ourselves if there's other people that are able to do that. We actually have secured our consultant. We've signed off the consultancy work, so that work is underway. It should be this week. I'm having my first meeting on that.
Great. Another just follow-up question. Do you have any examples of other countries that have achieved standardized competencies and have actually implemented a unique identifier for nurses?
When we looked at some of the different priorities, there was not a wealth of information. Are you aware of some that we are not, perhaps? They did do a scan, but comparing apples to oranges wasn't always the same.
Yeah, there are probably others on this session that may be able to respond to that. I'm not aware of a unique identifier. Catherine, maybe that's something that you have been engaged with.
The only work I know of for sure has been done in Denmark. Yeah. And as I recall off the top of my head, I think that most of the work was done with geriatric patients.
Okay.
Yes. And some of the collection elements were a bit of a challenge as well. There were some nuances, if you recall, Catherine.
Okay.
And there was a question. So PNAFT, our Principal Nursing Advisors, a task force will be leading this work as a collective and then reporting it up to CHU, which is the Committee for Health Workforce. But Ontario and BC are the provincial leads. And there is some pilot work, as you know, already underway by the regulators in the areas. Jennifer, I really enjoyed your presentation. And in Ontario, we're implementing nurse practitioners into primary care in correctional facilities and institutions right now. And it's interesting because as you show I'm also doing a postdoctorate fellow on system chief nurse executives at Case Western right now. And what you've identified is, again, some of the gaps. For example, where do corrections fall into that? In terms of your social determinants of health, it's very hard to capture or who are actually in conflict of the law, just being discharged from correctional institutions. And we're really trying to improve transitions from correctional institutions, whether they're remanded, awaiting sentencing, or discharged as well. So we really want to strengthen that, because usually it's the CHCs and NP-led clinics traditionally for the primary care models that tend to circle in on that, and high mental health and addictions rates, of course.
Right. Here's a question. Sally, you may want to expand on this, but to Jennifer, does your organization's EMR work link with your patients who are also home care patients and who are being assessed using the RIE-MDS?
It does. So all of these, there's other examples with mental health and addiction. So there's a lot of different standards that are collected for home care clients, for Canadian Mental Health Association clients. So there's all these different standards that we've created within our EMR to, again, try to not have people have to bounce around from data collection method from data collection method.
Okay.
I just have a question as well from Rebecca asking for labor involvement as well, and they have been involved with provincial and pan-Canadian, such as Ontario Nurses Association out of Ontario, but also the Canadian Nurses Union.
Great.
Lynn, okay. Sally, I have a question for Jennifer.
Sure.
When I'm involved in some data science research now, Lynn's actually on my committee, and what I'm looking at is using some artificial intelligence tools for predictive modeling. And I was wondering, when you're doing your research, are you using those types of tools yet, or what is generating?
It's like it's like my slide that I've got with all the ants, you know, my army of ants. I'm working very much with a group from Western. So some of our work was just presented at NAPCREG, the North American Primary Care Research Group conference, a few weeks ago, that I'd be happy to share with you. So we absolutely are exploring using artificial intelligence with our EMR data. Again, working with Dan Lizette, who is an amazing artificial intelligence researcher. We're pulling all of our EMR data into a secure platform at Western, where we're really trying to understand how to predict care outcomes and inform. But again, we want to really inform care. So it's complicated. We're doing a series of interviews right now with our providers to really understand what artificial intelligence tools or data would help you as a provider. And of course, people came back and said, we don't need anything about one condition. We want multimorbidity. We want to understand the risk factors of a whole bunch of sociodemographic and intersectionality on disease. So it's complicated, but we've got, I feel like, a bunch of really great minds working on it. Happy to connect you with anybody if you would like to talk to Dan or the group that's working on that project.
I'll be back in touch. I am at Western in the nursing.
Oh, great.
Yeah.
Okay.
Okay, so there's another question in the chat box for you, Michelle, and it relates to the national nursing regulators. Has the need for a licensing model for nurses who work across jurisdictions been noted? So nurses who are doing telehealth, flight nurses, consultants,
Yes, this is a significant issue. You know, we talked about a portable, nimble workforce, pan-Canadian mobility and things like that. But especially now with telehealth and COVID challenges, if we just had a presentation that mapped across all the provinces and territories, the challenge even with telehealth alone, where you need to be regulated, do you have a OHIP billing number, for example, as a nurse practitioner, not for billing, but for diagnostics? Do you need to be affiliated with a health authority and things like that as well? So there's some significant disparities and challenges as well. And we need to make sure that that unique identifier crosses all the provinces and territories and travels with that person as well.
Right.
Who knows where it will lead in the future, with subspecialties and tracking the full career trajectory of the nurse. You can see the possibilities, right?
Yeah, the follow-up question really relates to, what do you do with people who have multiple classes of registration? So somebody who works as an RN sometimes and extended class at other times, how does that deal with a unique identifier? Is that something you've talked about?
Yeah, that would hit specifically with the regulator, the common regulator approach right now, because, for example, if a nurse practitioner, you may actually, I'm registered in two provinces right now. So in Ontario, and I still practice clinically, I can practice no restrictions. I'm able to prescribe controlled drugs and substances. In Alberta, for example, I have a restriction that I am not able to do controlled drugs and substances, but I have completed the information, you know, demonstrated that, but I'm in a category because, for example, I just teach versus practice. So again, if we don't even have those nuances and what type of a sector we practice as nurses, as a clinician, as an executive practice, you know, in research or things like that, it's going to be a big challenge. So we really need to think about how that travels with us. So flight nursing, again, that's a significant issue, right?
Yeah, sure. Go ahead.
Even Kat. Right now, and helping with COVID-19 and how we're trying to help support some of the provinces and territories, the smaller ones right now, if you could even try and do telehealth with them, you need to be registered in a different province. How we did emergency and temporary registrations to help, that are good examples in COVID-19 that will be good case examples to and lessons learned to follow and map out.
Catherine, did you want to add to that?
Yeah, I think we have to be careful in that we differentiate between an identifier and that person's role. A person with a single identifier may very well have multiple roles. So you could have one role in Ontario, one role in Alberta, but you still have the same identifier. So there needs to be some clarity between role and identifier.
Good point.
Yeah, most definitely. I agree with you, Catherine, as well, because even if you're an advanced practice nurse, you have multiple domains and roles, right, as well.
Yeah, that's right.
Good distinction, though.
Michelle, I wanted to just ask you, relative to the advancing a national regulatory framework, given the degree of disruption that's happening across the country in terms of nursing organizations, do you see that as being an impediment to your work, with organizations moving increasingly away from the professional arm of their work to more of a focus on regulation solely? Is that problematic from your point of view?
I think it's two-tiered, to be honest with you. There is a shift, and as you know, in many of the some provinces and territories, the regulator also has a dual role as the association. And we're kind of mapping of what that looks like. There's been a few provinces that have just evolved most recently, if you've been following that. So I think there's strengths and opportunities of lessons learned, more importantly, how we need to modernize. And, you know, we think about regulation just in nursing, but if you look to, is anybody on here from BC right now, they're looking at modernizing regulation. So multiple health professions go under one regulator, for example, as well. So we need to be mindful of that and prepare for the future as well, not just the current state.
And I would suggest that, there's probably lots of lessons learned from places like Australia of what not to do. So there's a lot of things happening out there that we want to be sure that we don't replicate. So I just kind of leave that word of caution. But
right. Or even, following, everybody did raise some great points about what's happening on the global an international scale, but from the UK as well, there's a shift to right touch regulation and what that looks like. So we need to kind of be mindful. And then there's some elements that we might be doing in some of the provinces and territories, and they may say we are doing that, but we call it different things. So we need to be clear.
Good. Any other questions from anybody? Questions or comments?
Hi, Lynn, and hi, Michelle. It's Glenda Rees. I'm the president of CNIA, and I apologize. I did actually miss a few of the important sections in the beginning. But I I do want to just ask about students and how they would factor into the unique nurse identifier piece, because they're still entering data, but they're not yet graduated. And has that come up?
Yes, they were involved. Thank you for the question. They were involved in consultation, but also, you know, it's hard to see exactly where it will be, but we need that mm-hmm. to actually follow, I think, from a student placement perspective as well, and perhaps maybe where some of the placements are potentially.
Yeah.
What are your thoughts on that?
Well, I can see it being a major challenge because they're all working in different placements, and I am in BC and we have our different health authorities. So they're moving between health authorities, moving between paper, hybrid, electronic systems. You know, we're kind of behind on some of that, but
do you have suggestions? Yeah.
I don't. I would have to think about that. I do teach in the undergrad system, but it's I can see that being something to think about, and you know, maybe they use a student number until they registered. Mm-hmm. But it wouldn't necessarily, I don't know how you would keep it so that it would carry through. But thank you for your presentation, both you and Jennifer, and just in terms of CNIAA's involvement, we would very much like to be involved in the strategies you were discussing earlier. So thank you.
I would appreciate that. And if you don't mind, maybe if you could follow up in the email formally.
I will.
Based on what priorities you would like to be on, that way I can actually ensure I'm sharing with all the PNAs and the secretariat.
Absolutely, I'll do that. Thank you.
Jennifer, just a question in terms of the case studies that you presented. I think, you know, the examples were very, very powerful, and I think very much exemplified what we have been talking about wanting to be able to do in certain jurisdictions with some of our standardized nursing data. Are your cases published, the article that you provided the reference for, are those cited in there?
The COPD, so the model paper is cited, but I didn't cite the, so we've published the COPD case study. I can share that with you, and we've got the mental health case study in submission. So, but I'm happy to share the COPD link for you.
Great, thank you. All right, we've got a couple more minutes before we turn to our last discussion for today. Any other questions or comments for Dr. Acorn or Dr. Rayner?
May I ask a question to Dr. Rayner?
Sure.
I'm always working on this from the nursing element, obviously, in health workforce planning. I applaud you on your success and momentum on this, because as you know, it'd be really nice to have total comprehensive data versus pockets where it's just, you know, CHCs and MP-led clinics and how we're comparing across that. Any thoughts or suggestions for me?
I think, you know, within primary care, I mean, we've got the CHI-HI content standards, which, you know, we've mapped some of ours. I think the equity lens is missing from the CHI-HI content standards. I think that would be an amazing place to start. It includes a wealth of information, but add those, that equity data. I think that's so important. You know, I mean, to me, that's the biggest piece is just the CHI-HI content standards. I've sort of laid it out. They seem to have face validity. Like, you know, as I sort of shop them around with our standards across Canada, people, it resonates with folks. It does allow them to sort of comprehensively describe what they're doing, which to me is important. You want the data to be meaningful. Mm-hmm. And when we started way back, it was really just this void. And we thought, like, I wanted to be able to make sure that every data element that I was asking a provider to enter had meaning. And so I can trace it back to one of those attributes within the model. And to me, that was so important. So when people were, you know, so upset because I was asking them to enter extra EMR data, I could say, well, the reason why we're collecting it is it's going to give us the answer to this. And that helps so much. So if you can do that and not just collect a bunch of widgets for widget's sake. I think it really helps with the information you're asking people to take time to collect.
That's helpful. Our team for Ministry of Health and Ministry of SoulGen mm-hmm. got accepted for the CHFI extra team fellowship, and we just actually built what you talked about, and we put one of our priorities as in health equity, and we're trying to do the metrics right now exactly how you say. So that makes me feel better. Thank you.
Excellent. Catherine wanted to say something about the SNOMED ICMP integration. Go ahead, Catherine.
It was announced very recently within the last month that ICMP and SNOMED have now got a formal agreement that integrates ICMP into SNOMED. And as you all know, SNOMED is InfoWay's recommended clinical terminology. I just wanted to suggest, Lynn and Peggy, that it might be worthwhile after Christmas or after the new year to invite Nick Hardiker and or Jane Miller to do a presentation in this series, because I think it's relevant to the work that Jennifer's been reporting, and also Dr. Acorn's.
Excellent suggestion, Catherine. Thank you. Lynn, was that the meeting that was
for a moment?
It's yeah, go ahead.
I'm involved with that work as one of the. What am I called? A mapper, I believe. Bringing in ICMP interventions into SNOMED and making sure that some of our nursing interventions are actually captured within SNOMED appropriately. So that work is ongoing now. And so if we need any connections for any of the folks, Ian Green, Jane, or of course, we all know Nick, I'd be happy to connect with them. I talk to them each week.
Great. Thanks, Jillian. All right, so with that, I'm going to thank both of you again for your time and really, really appreciate both of your presentations today. I think it was a really nice wrap up to our four series seminars. And sorry we couldn't all be together, but I think, you know, we're going to keep an eye on the work that you're both doing. I think it's very important work for many, many reasons. And I think there are many people on the session today who probably will be interested in staying abreast of your work as it unfolds. And I think in any such way that we can provide input, I think we're always willing and quite keen to participate. So thank you both.
Thank you.
Well, thank you as well. And, you know, Lynn and Peggy, I'm not sure if everybody else knows, but we have a very strong relationship. We have for about 3 years now since I've been the PCNO and 2 years as co-chair. So thank you again for your leadership and expertise. And any support and collaboration is certainly open and really appreciated. So thank you.
Thank you.
Bye, okay. Everyone. Stay well and safe.
Yes, thank you. So Jody, can we put up the last few slides? So, well, we couldn't finish our session today without talking about what's next. So Peggy and I just put a couple of slides together just to get you talking and thinking a little bit about what do we do now. And so 2021 is around the corner. We've managed to have our virtual symposium this year, and I think it's been successful and we've had very positive feedback. So the next slide, Jody. So what we were interested in hearing a little bit from you about today, and we can have follow-up conversation via email, but we'd like to know if you have any specific ideas or suggestions for continuing to advance the work. And so, if anybody has any thoughts right off the top of your head today, please feel free to share in the chat or to voice those.
Well, I guess I jumped the gun on you, Lynn, a little bit. Sorry.
Yes, okay.
I I will not reiterate, but I would like to know more about Jillian's involvement. The audio wasn't too clear, so maybe that's another piggyback that we can add to it. Jillian's involvement in the ICNP SNOMED work.
Great idea. Yeah. Okay. Good. That would be a good compliment piece to that, Jillian. No pressure.
Sorry, I'm taking off a mask at the same time so I can talk a little bit more clearly. But I think other people that might be interested in that particular conversation would be Lori Block at UBC, because she's been doing a number of pieces of work with Nick that I likely don't even know all of them.
Okay, that's great. So noted. Any other thoughts? Well, you can keep thinking. We can go to the next slide, Jody. So I guess the other question then, are there specific topics? So we've got one already. Is there something that we've talked about over the course of the last four sessions that you'd like to revisit? Are there things that we didn't talk about this year that you'd like to hear more about? We've spent probably most of our focus really looking at what's happening in the field. And I think some good lessons learned have been provided by our various speakers. Anything that we haven't touched upon that perhaps we started to talk about in one of the previous symposia that you'd like to pick up on? Is there anything at all? So I think at this juncture, Peggy and I do our best to try and figure out what might be of value and of interest to the group and what aligns with the work that we're trying to achieve. Peggy, did you want to add anything?
No, I think it's just really getting feedback and learning from you about other sessions of interest. So we do have some ideas, and I guess people can always follow up after if something comes to their mind. We're certainly interested in continuing to offer this type of symposium. We're just not sure what 2021 will look like.
Yeah.
Lynn and Pat Rothney.
Yes, Pat. It's
very interesting to have an update from Dr. Acorn and their work in about 6 months' time.
Sure.
They have very large pieces of envisioning and collaboration on their agenda that have been a challenge in the past. So it's wonderful to see them sitting and working together, but it would be nice to hear of progress.
Good suggestion. Jody, I just had a couple of more slides. I don't know if you still have them there. So topics. So then the other question is, we had a sort of a split in people's views of whether they wanted to continue the sessions virtual. We might not have a choice, but I'm hoping that by some point next year, we will have a choice. But I think given the nature of the sessions that we've delivered this fall, I think it's worked well. People have been positive about it. But if we had the chance to come back together again, I guess the question to think about is, would you want to come back together and gather in an in-person symposium? And you don't have to answer this. It was really just to think about whether or not this is something that we might want to go back to when we're allowed to. This is certainly much more cost effective. So somebody suggesting a hybrid approach might be best, with a mix of in-person and virtual. Yeah, I think that's a good thought. For one, I miss seeing everybody. It's nice to see everybody. Even though it is probably a much more efficient way for us to gather. In any case, if you don't have any further suggestions in terms of topics, you all know how to find us, Peggy and I, and we will be sort of starting to think about what next year will bring, and think about how we will proceed and what kinds of topics we'll pick up on, and again, bring you up to speed with some of the initiatives that are underway that you have heard about in terms of current state. So I think on behalf of Peggy and myself, I want to wish you all a really wonderful holiday season, as much as you can be celebrating. Stay safe and keep well. And there was one last slide there, Jody. She wants to take them away, but that's okay. I just wanted to say it's been great to have your participation. I thank all of you for gathering with us over the last four sessions, and I think it's been a really great way for us to at least have a touch point with each other over the course of the last few months. And there is another suggestion on the site, so I will capture that. And I think with that, unless Peggy has anything to add, we're going to let you get on with your day, and hope that everyone has a wonderful holiday season. So there it is. All the best to everybody. Thank you.
Bye, everyone.